Well, we're off to a good start. So let me do the following. I'm going to introduce our three panelists. We'll each let them speak for about 10 minutes, and then we'll have time for questions. So with that, Thomas Dukes is the senior advisor to the State Department's Coordinator for Cyber Issues. He focuses on cybercrime, cybersecurity, national security, and capacity building. Before that, he was at CSIPS, the Computer Crimes and Intellectual Property Section of the Department of Justice, which is, of course, one of our premier institutions in cybersecurity. And he's also a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force Reserves. François Rivasseau is known, of course, to many of you here already. He was the DCM at the French Embassy at the U.S. He's had a distinguished career. He's currently the deputy head of the EU delegation to the United States. Been here about a year, almost on the nose, in that position. But many, many times in the past, his career is focused on disarmament, security, multilateral affairs. He was the ambassador to Geneva, which is a perfect place for security and international multilateral affairs, the spokesperson for the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the head of the mission, the ministry's UN directorate, which is a focus of attention here for cybersecurity in the coming year. Finally, Bruce McConnell, who also is probably known to everyone as all our panelists are. He's the senior counselor of the National Protection and Programs Directorate at DHS. I've, of course, known Bruce for a long time. He was on the transition team. Before that, he was in the private sector. Before that, he was in OMB, which is the true center of power, as many of you know, here in the U.S. government. And we're very happy that we can have all three panelists here to speak to you. Why don't we do the following? Why don't we just go one, two, three to make it a little easier? We'll start with Bruce and then go end up with Tom.
Thank you, Jim. Good morning, everyone. It's great to be here, although I must say Deputy Secretary Lute is a hard act to follow. So that's a good thing. But we're really happy to be here. And I wanted to comment on a couple of things and draw out a couple of the conversations that that Jane and Cecilia started, because I think there's some interesting threads here that we can pull on collectively over the course of the day and in the future work that the Commission is going to be doing in this important area of transatlantic cybersecurity cooperation. So starting kind of from home, I would note that there's actually a fairly large footprint of DHS people here at the conference, and I think that's instructive because it takes me back to an article that Deputy Secretary Lute and I wrote in Wired, I guess it was about a year and a half ago, which the main thrust of which is that cyberspace is civilian space. So there are many metaphors. We all of us who work in this field are always searching for them because we can't see very far into the future, and so we're always trying to reason by analogy. And with all analogies, they take us partway, and then they produce some bizarre conclusion, and you think, well, that's the end of that analogy. So we all have good examples of that. But if you think about some of the things that cyberspace can be thought of, whether it's a schoolyard or a classroom or a library or a marketplace, the one thing that we asserted in that article that we do not want it to become, at least by its very nature, is a battlefield. And so it is, I think, instructive that the administration and that this event today has such strong representation from a civilian agency, Homeland Security, and the administration's legislative proposal asks the Congress to give us the primary responsibility for securing cyberspace in the United States. And I think that, from a government standpoint anyway, and of course with the caveat that a government can't do this and governments can't do this by themselves. So to that point, I think a second interesting aspect of the conversation today, and as you heard this morning already, is the initial focus that many of us have and many of us collectively internationally have on so-called cybercrime. And so we have the Budapest Convention, which is the probably principal government-to-government instrument at the moment that covers cooperation in cyberspace. And it is, we were happy to see in the most recent, I guess 2 days ago, announcement, fact sheet from the President Obama and Prime Minister of Japan, Noda, that the Japanese are have decided to accede to the Budapest Convention. So that's a major, extension of it to outside of the normal Atlantic sphere. And so very promising, and we hope that's just the beginning of more broader international participation in that point. But I think as you tease out the different kinds of pieces and threads of how we deal with this large problem of a safe and secure and resilient cyberspace, there are a number of threads. And so the cybercrime piece is an interesting one because, in fact, of course, almost every attack that we encounter every day is a crime. In the United States, any unauthorized attempt to access a computer system of someone else without their permission or to deny service to it is a federal crime. But we don't generally prosecute under that statute. It's very difficult to prosecute under. And, in fact, the focus that we all collectively work on as governments is a subset of those crimes, which I would call cyber-enabled crimes. And so that is the kind of thing where we all are in agreement that child pornography is not, an appropriate thing to have in cyberspace. And so we attack that as a cyber-enabled crime, among other tools. We attack, intellectual property crimes that are enabled by by the Internet. We attack financial crimes that are enabled by the Internet. And so there's a whole rich area of collaboration and cooperation in that area. And I think we need to continue as governments to increase the sway and use of law enforcement tools in this area. And I know the second panel with my colleague Steve Chubinsky is going to take up that question in more detail. So you can then get to a couple of other things, three other areas, I think, that are interesting that we all work on and to think about because they deal with different parts to it. So there is the problem of cyber defense, of the possibility which our colleagues in Estonia and Georgia are those countries which know they've been hacked in this context, and so are leading the charge in Europe to get others to understand the importance of this issue from a national security level. And in that area, as the deputy said, there's another one of the areas of a great debate about roles and responsibilities of the state in this area and of the defense establishment. But there's no doubt that there is a role and that there are adversaries that we all face that are, national governments and that inevitably cyber will become an element of conflict going forward. And so that's not something that you can deal with, particularly well or effectively in the law enforcement context, in my opinion, and it is an area that needs to be dealt with in its own right. So the third area is what I think of generally, in which is our core mission at Homeland Security, which is from in this space, and that's cybersecurity. And this is securing the Internet itself. It's a place that can be supportive of our ability to defend against cyber adversaries from a nation-state standpoint. It can also be supportive of reducing cyber crime, but it's really about the defense of the networks and the defense of the information and the protection of identities. And it's in this space that we get into why it's important to have a civilian agency doing this. And as the Deputy Secretary said, from the standpoint of cybersecurity and homeland security generally, it's really a kind of a bottom-up thing. It's not a top-down thing. And so in national security and in national defense, the actual, the norm is that you wait until you are attacked or are about to be attacked before you do something. In policing, in Homeland Security, you can't wait for that. If the population is afraid in the local jurisdiction, you are already behind the curve. You have to act proactively to defend and create environments which are resilient, which include empowered individuals. So in cyber, that connects with our Stop, Think, Connect campaign, an awareness campaign, and I know the Europeans are thinking about a similar kind of campaign, and we're talking to them about that, about capable communities, and that's if you translate that piece of resilience into cyberspace, you're talking about all the various networked communities and making sure they're able to defend themselves, right? And then a responsive federal system that can aid and assist that, whether it's through sharing of threat information and remediation alerts to coordination of response when incidents reach a national level. And so in that context, there's a bunch of areas where we collectively are cooperating, right? So we talked about the emerging collaboration and cooperation on botnets. There are several interesting approaches. The Australians have an interesting approach. The Germans are well along on an approach, and this is under broader conversation in the European Union. And we now, as you know, have had a couple of successes here working with the ISPs on a voluntary basis to promote the stopping of botnets. There was discussion earlier about the importance of managing the domain name system. And, of course, on all this, we are cooperating on a bilateral basis and increasingly multilaterally on operational matters. We were recently in India where we have signed a CERT-to-CERT cooperation agreement, and that allows us to, if we see attacks that appear to be coming from India, we can call them up and ask them to, check in with the hosting company and see what there's going on, and they can do the same with us. And so that can be quite helpful, and this operational cooperation and collaboration can work as all cybersecurity actually works that's effective on the Internet in a very informal basis among communities of trust. So the fourth area, just to capture the overall picture here, is the question of Internet content. We all, both Europeans and the United States, in our international strategies talk about the importance of keeping the Internet open. And that means open from a technology and interoperable standpoint, but it also means it is an open place for discourse. And this is an area where, in my opinion, there is the least amount of international agreement, and we will have a long set of conversations about how to deal with the problem of what content is viewed as appropriate by governing bodies in various jurisdictions. And so that's a longer-term conversation, and it's not strictly about cybersecurity. But on the other hand, it does relate to the nature of cyberspace. And I think for those of us who think about these questions about what is cyberspace and how does it work and how does it become an environment for humans to collectively discuss and take action on global problems, this question of content will become increasingly important and something we'll need to deal with. So you have those four threads, and then on top of that, you have the question of governance. How do you manage these things collectively? And for that, just as the deputy said, we're trying to make sure that we can get the machines to help us protect them by automating some of the response and alert aspects of it. So too, I think we have to use the Internet to help us govern it, because we cannot only rely on the agility of standing governments and standing government institutions. We found already in cybersecurity that it's certainly true if you can work informally and collectively to get things done, and I think we will need to continue to develop institutions that are Internet-based for the future to govern some of these problems, and that is very much still a work in progress, I think, for all of us. So I'm asking only that as we increase our dialogue and cooperation that we take the big picture and the long view, I guess, since this problem will be with us for a long time, and it's an exciting area, and I just want to echo the points made earlier about how important this particular collaboration is. So I look forward to the discussion. And maintenant, au sentiment de François.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
I am in an even more challenging situation than you, because not only I have to speak after the elegant, that was the terms I think appropriate, and blunt and firm speech of my commissioner, but she's here. And let me tell you, we are very motivated to work with Commissioner Malmström, particularly because she knows how to motivate people. And you know, she didn't ask her collaborators to review what I was going to tell you. So it's an example of the way she works. Really, she knows how to create a stimulating environment. We have to talk about transatlantic cooperation. Let me just start with one raw fact. The volume of data crossing the Atlantic Ocean from the US to Europe and vice versa over communication infrastructure exceeds by far, by very far, any data flows between other regions or with other regions. And another raw fact is that we share basically the same value, and this is also a unique element of our relationship. And although we don't have necessarily the same privacy conceptions, we have different laws and different federal structure, but we share the same values, and that's what the debate we have on both sides on the Atlantic on how to walk the narrow path between the need of regulate against cybercrime, for cybersecurity, to protect critical civilian infrastructure, to fight against terrorism on one hand, but also on the other, to promote out in other countries, to preserve in our countries freedom of internet, and also to maintain a business-friendly environment as much as we can, because on both sides of the Atlantic, we need the jobs and growth. And we know that the big internet firms are, for the time being, still in Europe and in the US, so it's our common interest. So we share so many things. That's why our cooperation is so important. Let me just start. My first point will be on the state of play, my second point about the agenda, and my third point about concrete measures. State of play. As Commissioner Malmström put it so well, cybersecurity on both sides of the Atlantic have evolved rather differently. And in the US, the issue of cybersecurity has become part of national security policy for a long time, and is therefore a more matured policy field, maybe, compared to that in the EU. The first US national cyber strategy is 2003. While in the EU, cybersecurity is something more recent, seriously, since 2008, 2009, with, for the first time, EU-wide policies focusing mostly on internal market. But in the last years, on one hand, the Lisbon Treaty set up a new dimension for cybersecurity in CFSP fields. And most important, under the, at the initiative of Commissioner Malmström, mostly, DG Home, EES, DG Information Society have engaged into the discussions on preparing an EU strategy for cyberspace. And this really shows that we know that we have to come after that quickly. And as she put it, and for the reason she put it, particularly related to cybercrime, but for many other reasons also, that you know, it's an issue of emergency. And I can tell you that we plan to try to achieve that as fast as possible, because we know it cannot wait. Because of critical dependencies also between the US and EU companies, you know that if there's not still a complete trade market between EU and US, there is a trade investment market in a way. You perfectly know the stats that there is direct US investment in the Netherlands, which are higher than the total US investment, direct investment in China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and Russia altogether. So we have such a big community of companies. A company which is American registered usually is partly owned by European stakeholders, and vice versa. So because of these critical dependencies between our US and EU company, further policy cooperation is desirable in many fields. And the current EU-US working groups cover only a fraction of this field. So therefore, the strategy, and this strategy is obviously designated to allow us to work on our more comprehensive approaches. Awareness on our dependencies will grow also. And obviously, part of the landscape is that some member states, EU member states, have a strong and very developed relationship with you. And this is part also of our cards, our hand, and a very important dimension of our landscape. We work together, member states and the EU Commission, to serve the same objectives. In the foreign policy aspect of cybersecurity, the Department of State was initially, maybe, should I say, a bit reluctant initially, to include strategic and diplomatic cybersecurities into US-EU working groups agenda. And initially, the US did prefer to have direct contact with EES and member states on global and foreign policy issues and not to deal specifically with cyber. But now we have a strategic dialogue on cybersecurity, which has been proposed. And the EES Security Policy Directorates had close working relations with the Department of State Cyber Policy Coordinator's offices. And this is also a field which is developing quickly. So what could be the agenda? If we have the tools now, if we have a will, if we shall have on the EU side soon the strategy, what could be the agenda? First, EU and US as strategic partners have to uphold democratic values and the rule of law, which should preserve open and free cyberspace. But we need for that norms of behavior in cyberspace. Norms of behavior, we have, as in other domain, existing laws and rules which have to apply and to be implemented fully to this new domain. And this is a very technical challenge. We have for cybercrime issue, as Commissioner Malmström explained to you, the Budapest Convention. For conflict in cyberspace, we have also, and that's part also of a dimension of a cyber convention, but also some results of some conclusions we had also in New York. The good part of the conclusions in New York is that we have reassessed that international humanitarian law and law of armed conflicts are of application in the cyberspace. And confidence-building measures are important, and we think could be developed currently to stabilize cyberspace. The principles of human rights law also apply. And to have a common vision on what are the rules of application is essential if we want to shape the agenda. Secondly, on cybercrime and cybersecurity, we have obviously a very practical cooperation. I think this will always remain at the center of our work, and this has been described by you, Bruce, so I will not come back to it. Private sector, the contact between our businesses will also define dynamics, a certain dynamic in transatlantic cyber relation. And it is crucial to define how to protect the most critical parts of our interdependent infrastructure, how to coordinate that in the transatlantic format. There are many exercises. When I was ambassador in Geneva, I remember in 2005, we have launched already a first reflection on the protection of civilian critical infrastructure. And it's sure that the cyber protection, that is probably the most important dimension of all that. Harmonized legal environment for provide security of functioning for business is also very important and should be also on the agenda. And we have also to stimulate the contact between cybersecurity communities working every day in the US and the EU. So this is basically the main elements of the agenda. And what could be maybe the main priority, concrete priorities, if I have to go a bit more in depth, I think the application of existing international law and developing norms in cyberspace is a first challenge. But I would mention briefly two others. To strengthening the global response on cybersecurity capacities. Many cyber threats, it has been pointedly recalled by Commissioner Malmström, emanate from territories where there is weak state capacity to deal with cyber incidents and cybercrime investigations, territories with no legal system present that would allow hold accountable criminal misusers of computers and with weak capacity. If I may remind a personal experience at the time when I was spokesman, one day I was in charge of internet of a department of the French Department of State, the French Quai d'Orsay. And one day, while opening my computer, going on my website, I see that the word France had been replaced by a very little country. It was in 2004. Maybe it will tell you something. Well, and then I said, okay, we should be able to know, at least to know who did that, just only to congratulate him for his sense of humor. But we should be able to have an idea of who did that. Then we went, I can tell you, to all the security services, and when I say all, I say all, the French security services. And we were able, through legal means, to see that this was coming from a tiny country a tiny island country in Africa. I will not name it, but a very, very small country, completely undeveloped, no law at all. And then we were told we have no agreement with this country. We cannot track the thing. It's absolutely impossible. You know? So that's a long-standing challenge that I hope to see one day sold out. And I think there is a niche from EU and US to really prove to the rest of the world that we can develop security in developing countries in cyberspace without sacrificing freedom. And but we have to put some money on that. We shall have to put some money on that. And at the time where money is rare, we have to coordinate how we do that because we have the same objectives here. And that's an important part of a follow-up of a so-called London process that, as you know, we are very interested by and we have very important stakes at it since November last year. But there are also some aspects in strengthening cybersecurity capacities that we should take into account. But it is also of the interest of the EU and probably of the US to prevent developing transition country becoming hubs of cybercrime, but also developing country to completely establish, as Secretary Clinton put it in a very famous speech a bit more than 1 year ago, a new walls on internet. What was the exact formula?
New foreign policy imperative?
No, it was in her speech when she said, you know, you had the Cold War with the Berlin Wall, and what we want to avoid is that some countries establish new walls on internet. And for example, in the EU has begun when discussing sanctions for a country like Syria, for example, to make sure that when we establish arms embargo and we extend the conception of the arms embargo to cyber tools we can be used for repressing the population and preventing it to establish links. I think this is a kind of reflex of automatic reaction that we have to develop and to think automatically, more automatically to that. Finally, I would say, I would come back to the problem of United Nations. We have a discussion, an important discussion in the United Nations and a major initiative by China and Russia to increase through a proposal to frame the discussion in classical arms control terms and mechanism, to orientate that to favor more government control over the free flow of information. This is not. This is also an issue on which we have to talk, because we see some merits in having a UN-based démarche. We see some merits. We need the UN legitimacy to be sure to build up a global capacity. At the same time, we would like to be able to focus or refocus the main purpose of that to really cybersecurity in preserving freedom of information. That's why we really need to act together to get also capacity of influencing the debate there. I should stop here because I've been far too long. And I beg you your indulgence with me, because I hope that Commissioner Malmström will not cut my head, but I know that's not the way she behaves. She is absolutely not like that. Thank you for your attention.
And thank you to CSIS for sponsoring this. For sponsoring this event and inviting us to participate. I will start out by saying I largely echo all the comments that have been made by the previous speakers, particularly in terms of the very strong working relationship between the U.S. and the EU on cybersecurity matters. If you set aside the data privacy issues, then I think you find that we're almost in complete lockstep on most of the key issues. And also, as Francois, I think, very well teed up for you at the end of his comments, that we both look ahead and see a number of very significant coming debates that have already begun, but that are going to be very active in the year ahead at the UN, on things such as the group of governmental experts looking at norms for state behavior in cyberspace, at the UN's International Telecommunication Union World Conference on Information Technology that's going to take place in Dubai this December, looking at revising its treaty document and how cyber issues can or should play in that document. And I think it's very encouraging, certainly from a U.S. government policy perspective, to know that we have in the EU such a strong partner on these very high-level policy debates and challenges that we face ahead. What I'd like to do is just spend a few minutes talking to you about a couple of, I think, fairly concrete or maybe narrowly focused areas in which we are currently engaged with the EU and that perhaps offers some examples for continued successful engagement and cooperation and collaboration. And so I'll first put on my hat as a senior policy person for the Office of the Coordinator for Cyber Issues at the State Department, which is an office that was created in February of 2011 when Secretary Clinton appointed my boss, Chris Painter, to serve as her first coordinator for cyber issues. And this was something that was done in conjunction with the finalization of the U.S. International Strategy for Cyberspace that came out in May of last year. And the basic idea was, you know, looking at the State Department, which is largely organized along both regional bases and then functional bases, trying to figure out a way to ensure that within a large organization like that, in the same way that for the United States government we've created a cyber coordinator position on the National Security Staff, a way to ensure that, that policy decisions can be made that take into account and reflect all the different equities that we face in our foreign policy engagements. And so the office has been up and running now for about 14 months. And among the key things that are going on now that I think are worth noting for this group are, as Francois mentioned, we are increasingly engaging with the European Union in addition to key EU member states on a wide range of cybersecurity issues. We have a steady flow of EU and EC officials as well as senior officials from a wide range of countries, but particularly European countries, coming through the State Department, coming through our offices. And it's almost an exponential growth in the interest in talking about cyber. It's very encouraging. Sometimes it's almost overwhelming to try to just hit the key opportunities like this CSIS conference where we can talk about these issues. But certainly we're seeing a real interest across the board in engaging on cybersecurity. Another thing that's been very encouraging is to see that increasingly other countries have either come up with the same idea or followed the U.S. lead and are appointing senior officials to manage their cyber policy work, particularly in their foreign ministries. So France, the U.K., Germany, Japan, Russia, the Netherlands, have all within the last year appointed very senior officials to make sure that their governments have a clear point person who can manage and develop their cyber policy, lead their international engagement on cybersecurity and cyber policy issues. We're also seeing more and more countries issue national strategies that define how they view the key policy issues, how they've decided to organize their governments, how they've decided to engage with the private sector, and that's another very encouraging trend that we try to encourage countries to really think seriously about these issues. And again, keeping in mind that as we move through the next few years, there are going to be some incredibly important policy debates and international decisions that are going to be hashed out in places like the UN or the OSCE, or other key regional organizations like the EU and the Council of Europe, and APEC, and the Organization for American States. I mean, you can name any multilateral organization right now, and there is a very robust, high-level cyber work stream that's going on. But helping countries think ahead and start really forming their positions on a lot of these key policy issues that relate to internet governance, that relate to norms, that relate to how we deal with cybercrime. And that's where, you know, again, the U.S. and the EU can really work very effectively together to help other countries understand the issues, understand the implications, particularly of things like the Russian-Chinese code of conduct, and help them see that the kind of the high-level views that the U.S. and the EU promote are really the most consistent with notions of international law, human rights, ensuring that we have a safe and secure, open, interoperable internet. So a couple of the other key things that I'll just highlight are that our office is increasingly working with EU institutions or European Commission institutions like the External Action Service to find ways that we can better integrate our capacity building efforts. The U.S. conducts a very robust international training program focused particularly on cybercrime and cybersecurity, also countering terrorist use of the internet, that's funded by the State Department out of both our counterterrorism and our narcotics, international narcotics and law enforcement bureaus. And one thing that's been missing, though, is the same level of engagement by institutions like the EU, by individual EU member states. But we're starting to see much more interest, particularly by key countries, like key partners like France and Germany and the UK, in making a much more robust investment in their capacity building efforts in places like Africa and Asia. And we're working on a number of upcoming programs that the State Department will be leading, where we're going to be doing joint programs that will include EU and EC and a number of other key partners, including other G8 countries such as Japan, in our capacity building efforts. And we think that's a great way to go forward. Let me shift now to talking for a minute about cybercrime, which is most of my background is as a career cybercrime prosecutor with the Department of Justice. I'm currently working at the State Department on a temporary detail. And I also chair the G8 Roma Leone Group's high-tech crime subgroup, so I have a little bit of experience dealing with cybercrime. And I think if we look at the successes we've had in addressing cybercrime, they're really instructive and provide a really good model for how we can tackle other challenges, like helping ensure countries have secure and resilient networks. We've been dealing with cybercrime, we collectively, the U.S., Europe, for almost 25 years now, that we've been in a focused way building our capacity and our capabilities to combat cybercrime. And a couple of the key things that we use as the pillars for trying to create a world where there are no safe havens for cyber criminals to operate and all countries can effectively deal with cybercrime challenges are the promotion of the Budapest Convention, which currently has a little over 30 parties to it. The U.S. was one of the countries that helped negotiate the convention. We signed it when it first was open for signature in November of 2001. We ratified it, and it went into force in January of 2007. And what's been really good about sort of the last year, and I think the next year or two in terms of the convention, is that we've seen a number of countries that were involved with drafting the convention, signed it early on, such as the U.K., and Japan, that are now, UK last spring completed its ratification. Japan is 99% of the way there. We're also seeing good movement in other countries like Canada and Australia that have been working for years to become parties to the convention. But also there is a very steady flow of countries that are asking to become parties to the convention. So if you look, for instance, at the Council of Europe website, you see that in November, Senegal asked to become a party to the convention. South Africa is working towards and has signed becoming a party to the convention and has signed it. In Central South America, you have Chile, Argentina, the Dominican Republic, and a number of other countries, Mexico, that are in the process of becoming parties. The Philippines is in the process of becoming parties. And I know of at least five or six other countries that will, in the coming months, be announced as working towards becoming parties to the Convention on Cybercrime. So that's really encouraging, because what the Budapest Convention does is at its heart is it provides sort of a three-legged stool approach towards dealing with cybercrime. It says you have to have the right substantive laws that allow you to prosecute certain acts. You have to have the right investigative powers so that law enforcement can get stored communications and data, can get intercept in real time communications and data. And then also, and probably most importantly for this group, that there can be robust international cooperation, information sharing, and assistance. And one of the great things that the Budapest Convention does is it actually serves as a treaty. So if two countries are parties to the convention, but they don't have an existing treaty to deal with mutual legal assistance matters, sharing of information, the Budapest Convention itself serves as the treaty and allows that to operate. One of the other things that the convention encourages or says countries should do is be part of basically a 24/7 network that allows immediate assistance. It allows you to immediately request and receive assistance from foreign law enforcement, trusted foreign law enforcement counterparts. So one of the great things that exists to make that happen, that in fact one of probably the best success that I can point to in terms of international cooperation on cybercrime, is the G8 high-tech crime subgroup a number of years ago created a 24/7 network, which has now grown to 60 countries, and we're adding a new country every few months now, and includes a really wide range of countries from all over the world, and things like that can serve, I think, as very effective models for how we can work to build capacity by bringing countries along at different stages, getting them involved in, for instance, informal networks that can then lead to helping them build the institutional resources and the capabilities to then become better able to really deal with cybercrime on their own, to do things like join the Budapest Convention. We do a lot of international outreach and training to help countries draft laws, to help them set up certs, to help them build the investigative capacity to establish forensics labs. And that's the type of work that, particularly in the cybercrime area, that the EU and the US, I think, if we really put our minds to it, can find some great opportunities to collaborate and really help build the international community, raise the baseline so that there are no longer these instances, like Francois mentioned, where you have countries that are essentially safe havens for criminal actors or others who want to do bad things on the internet, that there won't be that problem. And I think we're making a lot of great progress towards that. So again, Jim, thanks for including us in the presentation, and if you have any questions along those lines, either here or later on offline, please feel free to reach out. I'd be happy to talk to you about any cybercrime or foreign diplomacy issues.
Great, thank you. Very full presentations. And we have a few minutes for questions if people have any. I've got a couple. Maybe I'll start by asking all three panelists, if you were going to think of where the strengths of transatlantic cooperation might be, where the operational areas, the not the policy, not the negotiation, but the operational areas where there's a benefit or a possibility for cooperation, and would this be more than crime? Crime is sort of easy. Everyone thinks it's bad. Almost everyone thinks it's bad. But are there other areas? And particularly when you think about information sharing, how much do you create the same, how much do you face the same kind of risks or problems you would face on information sharing for passenger data when you think of information sharing for cybersecurity? So I don't know if you want to, but where, how would an operational approach work?
So a great question. So I think, there's probably many areas of fruitful operational collaboration. Let me talk a little bit about some of the ones that are ongoing today, because I think those are the ones we've identified that are already working for us well. So late last year, we held a U.S.-EU Cyber Atlantic tabletop exercise, which took place a year earlier than it was originally scheduled. So, we were agile there and looked at two different cyber attack scenarios and how the roles and responsibilities would work. There was an after-action report for that, which is going to set for a series of annual, incident management conversations between us, and in particularly involving the European Network and Information Security Agency, ENISA. So that is working well. It obviously connects also with the bilateral cooperation that we have, with individual countries. And that continues. So on the sort of testing and incident management approach, I think that's a big piece of it, and I'll come back to the information sharing point because that, of course, is critical to that cooperation. But let me just mention a couple of other areas that we're working together on. We're working together on awareness raising, so in the context of empowered individuals, right? We're going to be doing some work. We have our Stop, Think, Connect campaign, which I mentioned, and that's a conversation with the Europeans about what's the uniquely European way to attack that question. And we're also going to be doing some work together on best practices for child protection online, scheduled to coincide with the U.S.'s National Cybersecurity Awareness Month this October. So that's exciting. And then in the third area is just working the public-private partnership. So as was stipulated earlier, governments can't do this. We need everybody's help. So there's some particular work that we're doing together in the industrial control systems area. And next week we're having a conference in Savannah. There'll be an International Partners Day as part of that. And there's also work together on botnet. So I think there's a lot of areas of operational collaboration. I think on the information sharing front, the approach that we've found successful in the United States, and we've also found successful in bilateral arrangements, is to really just whenever you share information, state what the agreement is about how it can be handled. So you can use the red, yellow, green approach, that it's just for that conversation, that it can be shared with a trusted group, or it can be more broadly disseminated. And I think at this point, we're in a place where we have to kind of deal with it on a case-by-case basis and get some experience before we come up with a overall framework for that area. But I think that can work quite well as long as you're explicit up front about how it would be shared.
About information sharing, it is a difficult area because it involves usually a lot of information sharing on business solutions and practices. Let me compare that to another field, which as a member of the Advisory Board of Ban Ki-moon, we feel at UN level is useful to think about, which is the bioprotection. When you think about the convention prohibiting biological weapons, you will see that when you want to share information about bioweapons and good practices, you face a bit the same problem, because in a way you have to have the aggressive software to know how to defend yourself against, and usually this involves intellectual property problems. And if you think to bio, just if you forget 1 second about computers and you think about bio, it's exactly the same problem. You need to have the bacteriological agent, which is usually refined and worked out with increased performance, and which usually are part of intellectual property, highly sensitive information. And on this basis, you can find the defense. So in both cases, the situation is a bit similar. What did we do in the biofield? We tried to promote a minimum level of protection. First, we need a universal norm that we have in the biofield, but we still have to work out in the cyber field. We need good practices and regular meetings between experts on good practices. First of all, to be prepared in the Western framework, because we are the most advanced, both in internet and in bio. But on the other hand, after that, to be expanded to the whole world, because as you rightly pointed out, the solidity of the defense is worth the solidity of the weakest point of a defensive chain. So you have to have a global ambition if you really want to get something. And then in this context, when you have established the proper context, then you have experts who can, then you identify the most you can share. And usually you will see that in the proper context, you discover that you can share much more than you would have thought initially without having set up a proper context. So that would be my answer on information sharing.
Just very briefly, obviously information sharing is one of the hottest, you know, current issues facing us in terms of dealing with cybersecurity. You only have to look at the plethora of bills in Congress currently, most of which are focused extensively, if not often exclusively, on how to help the government better share information internally and with the private sector. But in terms of kind of existing, I think, successful operational information sharing things that we can look to, one is, again, going back to the criminal law enforcement example, it's amazing within law enforcement channels how effectively we're able to share information, the U.S. with a wide range of countries, often countries that we don't necessarily work very well in really any other context with. But the law enforcement world has really developed some very good formal and informal mechanisms over the last few decades to figure out how to share information about cyber crime investigations. And one sort of direct positive result from that you see are increasing joint international criminal investigations and takedowns, whether it's of groups like Anonymous or reaching back, you know, even 5 or 6 years, huge carding organizations like Operation Firewall that the Secret Service carried out. You're increasingly seeing, larger and larger groups of countries working together to tackle transnational cybercrime organizations that have members in many different countries, and very successfully being able to keep those investigations secret until the appropriate time, arrest people, execute search warrants, and do that very effectively. And I think that provides some very good lessons. And then just the other thing I would mention very briefly is another area where I think there's great opportunity and fantastic work being done right now by DHS is in expanding cert-to-cert cooperation. There's an international watch and warning network made up of a smaller group of countries, but one of the things I hear constantly as I travel around to different countries and international conferences is a real desire from international partners to find better, faster, more comprehensive ways that we can share information about threats, about signatures for malware. And I think, you know, as an area of focus on an operational area, that's one thing that will yield huge dividends for us, and that, again, that is particularly, I think, appropriate for discussions within the context of the U.S. and the EU's relations on cybersecurity.
Okay, we have one question over there. That might have to be the last one. Yeah. And could you introduce yourself?
I'm Alan Paller from the SANS Institute. The law enforcement sharing is pretty amazing, and the effects are impressive. But I think the largest lever we have that where there could be cooperation, where I think there is none, is in the buying power of the governments. Deputy Secretary Lute mentioned that one of the really big needs was to get the vendors to deliver technology with security baked in, to get the ISPs to deliver safer networking. Is there anything going on between the United States and Europe in sharing the buying power so that you can use the leverage of procurement to essentially make systems that we're buying defensible instead of indefensible?
You have rightly pointed out a very important problem. And the answer is we are not fully yet there. We are precisely, that's one of the issues the strategy is intending to answer. Personally, if I could make a wish at the end of this conference, you know, when I go to buy a computer, I have asked, is it possible to find a computer on the market which would allow me to physically disconnect the Wi-Fi so that I could be 100% sure that nobody can misuse my computer? And strangely, it should not be impossible to find that on the market. But go to Best Buy, go to Apple Store, go wherever. I've been answered, no. There's no computer with a physical disconnect of a Wi-Fi. So all the computers you have, they could theoretically be misused while you are not online. So you know, things of that kind, this kind of reflection is precisely an angle we want to reflect upon. Because It is key. But for that, we need a strategy. Let me just add that we have also, in the context of CSDP, a new tool, which a tool which is the European Defence Agency, which is trying to make the relationship with NATO between NATO member states, so to ensure that we are all talking about the same things, and they are also beginning to develop some kind of ideas we could be injected in our dialogue on how, because you know the procurement agency, they are precisely thinking about how to make procurement and tools. So this dimension, yes, we have it in mind, but we are not yet there.
No, I guess not. With that, could you join me in thanking our panel? We now have a coffee break, and then we'll reassemble for the second panel on law enforcement. Thank you.